My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and anyone who tuned in to our previous episode will know that we looked back at one of the greatest albums of the 90s, Blood Sugar Sex Magik by Red Hot Chili Peppers. And my guest, Elizabeth Evetts, who chose the album, was a fantastic guest, of course, and thank you so much to her for joining me on the podcast to chat about a great album by one of my favourite bands. Big fan of Red Hot Chili Peppers. Today, we're going to be chatting about Joe Satriani's breakthrough album, Surfing with the Alien. Now, I'm very excited that we're doing this one. It's the first album in the history of the podcast which is completely instrumental, no vocals whatsoever. And yet, as I'm sure you'll hear from my conversation with Sam Russell, who chose the album, it still manages to evoke all the kinds of emotion and feelings that you would get from any album with vocals. It certainly doesn't suffer in any way from having no lead vocalist on there. Fantastic instrumental album, Surfing with the Alien, and that's what we're going to be talking about very shortly here on My Classic Album. I'm very excited about some of the stuff that's coming up over the next few weeks and months, and a lot of it I can't talk about, which is really frustrating, but you know me, I don't like to reveal guests that we've got coming up and albums that we're going to cover until I'm sure that we've got everything locked down. But rest assured, keep an eye on our social media pages over the next few weeks particularly. Our Facebook page, My Classic Album with Mike Norris, is usually the first port of call, and it'll tell you guests that were coming on, the albums they've chose, and all sorts of other awesome stuff. Our Instagram page, My Classic Album Podcast, is also a really good source for that information. And we're also on Twitter, so you can follow us at @MCA_podcast. And all this information and all the latest news about the podcast is over at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. Or if you can't be bothered with all of that, just keep tuning in to our episodes and I'll keep you updated with what's coming up. One thing that I can tell you is happening very soon. In fact, the whole of November will be dedicated to Pink Floyd's magnum opus, if you like, The Wall. 40 years old in November, and we haven't done an anniversary episode in a while. And for me, 2019 has been a very Pink Floyd-y kind of year. Not in terms of anything that the band are doing, but just for me, kind of listening to their music and going back. And I was very late to the Pink Floyd party, and I will happily admit that. And I believe, was it Skunk Manhattan? I think it's when Skunk and I were talking about Appetite for Destruction. And we were discussing other albums we could do in the future and other bands that he liked. And he'd said to me, you know, Pink Floyd, it absolutely blew his mind. And I thought to myself, you know what, they're a band that I've never really delved into in the same way that I have a lot of other bands that we've done here on the podcast. And that was kind of my thing this year, that I thought that I'm going to rectify that. I'm going to sort that out. And a big way of doing that is to celebrate 40 years of The Wall, which is coming up in November. I'll be sure to give you more information about that as we get closer to it in terms of who's going to be on there. And I always like to kind of pepper the anniversary episode with something a little special if I can. And of course, I would love to know your thoughts on the album, or any of our albums really, but particularly The Wall, and your thoughts on your favourite song on the album. So by all means, start getting that information to me now through our social media pages, or you can email us at myclassicalbum@gmail.com and just let us know your favourite song from The Wall, your memories of that album, discovering that album, just anything about The Wall, and I'll be reading them out on the podcast along with the usual analysis of the album that we do, and hopefully something a little special too. But obviously we'll touch on that as we get closer and closer to November. I was very lucky to get a chance to see a band that I've been wanting to see for quite a while now. So anyone, regular listeners to the podcast, will know that I'm a huge fan of Blackstone Cherry. Now, I've seen them loads of times, so it's not as if this isn't where that's not where this is going. But, you know, they are one of my favourite bands. I've followed them for about 11 or 12 years now. John Fred Young, who plays drums in Blackstone Cherry, his father and his uncle play in the Kentucky Headhunters, who have been around in one shape or another for the last 50 years. They've certainly been known by that name for over 30 years now. And I've always kind of, as I got into the history of Blackstone Cherry and I was getting into the band, and obviously you hear about the Kentucky Headhunters, and I thought to myself, you know, these are a band that I'd really love to see, you know. And I didn't know if I'd ever get that opportunity, to be perfectly honest. And then they announced that they were doing this kind of triple-headed country rock, southern rock tour across the UK. And it was the Kentucky Headhunters, Jason and the Scorchers, and Dan Baird and Homemade Sin. Now, they're all fantastic bands. And if you're into that kind of music, it's a fantastic evening of live music. And I was toying with whether I was going to go or not. I wasn't completely sure. But then what sealed the deal was that a very good friend of mine, one of my best friends, who currently lives in Canada, he was over in the UK visiting for a couple of weeks, visiting family and friends, and him and his wife were actually going to the Newcastle date of this tour. I had been umming and ahhing the whole time, and that kind of sealed the deal for me that, you know, yeah, I should be going to this show. I've been wanting to see the Kentucky Headhunters for a while. You know, Phil is, he was always my gig buddy, so it was nice to be able to kind of rekindle that again for a night. And it was just a fantastic show. You know, all three bands were absolutely phenomenal, if you're into that kind of thing. The Kentucky Headhunters, it was interesting to see them live. And again, to go back to Blackstone Cherry for a moment, that I can see how heavily influenced Blackstone Cherry are by the Kentucky Headhunters. So from that perspective, it was a lot of fun to see these guys perform. You know, these are, you know, an iconic southern rock band, Kentucky Headhunters. If you've not heard of them, check them out. They're absolutely phenomenal. They did a lot of their own material. They did covers of House of the Rising Sun and Spirit in the Sky, which went down very well. And they were just, they were the band of the night for me personally. You know, Dan Baird and Homemade Sin, they headlined the night. They were fantastic. You know, I think that by the time this podcast goes to air, I think the tour will be over, unfortunately. There might be the odd date left. Don't miss the opportunity. If they come back to the UK and you like that kind of thing, just check it out. A fantastic night of live music. And I'm so glad that I made that last minute decision to go. It was worth every penny. But that was last week. This is now. My special guest is Sam Russell, and he has chosen Joe Satriani's fantastic Surfing with the Alien. But before we get to Sam and everything around Joe Satriani's fantastic album, here are the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Surfing with the Alien. Released on October the 15th, 1987, Surfing with the Alien is the second studio album from American guitarist Joe Satriani. The album was produced by Joe and John Cuniberti, who had also produced Joe's debut album the previous year. Surfing with the Alien was recorded at Alpha and Omega Recording and Hyde Street Studios in San Francisco. Surfing was released by Relativity Records, but because the label weren't sure with what direction to take Joe, the album only had a $13,000 budget, and many creative methods were employed to create the album we know today. The title track was released as the first single, and proved to be a surprise hit for the fledgling guitarist. Surfing with the Alien reached number 37 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart. Follow-up single, Always With Me, Always With You, also proved popular, both songs becoming an integral part of any Joe Satriani setlist. Satch Boogie was released as the third single from the album, reaching number 22 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart, sealing the album's fate as a huge success. The album made Joe Satriani a star overnight and solidified him as one of the greatest guitar players in the world. Surfing with the Alien reached number 29 on the Billboard 200 in the US, with it also charting across the world, most significantly hitting number 10 on the Australian album chart. Platinum certification in the US followed, and the album's success in the UK earned its silver status. Over time, Surfing with the Alien and the songs on it have come to represent the very best of Joe Satriani's phenomenal career. AllMusic called the album the gold standard for guitar playing in the mid-80s, while across its studio and live recordings, Always With Me, Always With You has been nominated for three Grammy Awards in 1989, 2002, and 2008. So that is everything we need to know about Surfing with the Alien. And I have here with me my special guest who chose the album today to talk about on my classic album. This is Sam Russell. How's it going?
Hi, Mike. Yeah, going great, thanks. It's been a nice warm day in the UK. It has, yeah, it's been great. So why did you choose Surfing with the Alien to talk about on My Classic Album today?
Well, when I first started learning guitar when I was a lot younger, I didn't really listen to much guitar-orientated music at the time. And my guitar teacher introduced me to Joe Satriani and the album Surfing with the Alien. And it just completely blew my mind with, I mean, I didn't know that a guitar could do what Joe Satriani did on that album. I'd never heard anything like it before.
Yeah.
And it was, I remember being really, really exciting for me at the time. So I thought it'd be a nice album to visit for your show.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, it's funny, I mean, I can actually, and as we'll touch on as we go on, I'm not a musical person, particularly, obviously I love music. I'm doing a podcast about music, but I don't have a musical bone in my body. But I remember hearing Surfing with the Alien, the title track, for the first time on, I think it was on one of these compilation albums, like the best air guitar album of all time or something.
Yeah.
And it just completely blew in my mind, like, say, thinking, you know, I didn't realize a guitar could do that. I know you've touched on a little bit of this already. What are your memories of hearing this album for the first time when it was introduced to you by your music teacher?
I remember being really excited by it. I think he lent me his copy of the CD or something like that. And I remember listening to the title track, Surfing the Alien. And I think I literally ran and got my mum. I was like, Mum, listen to this. This is amazing.
It is that kind of thing, though, isn't it? When you're discovering, when you're kind of into rock and metal and you're digging through and you're discovering, and then there is just something about that track. And we will touch on that track specifically in a bit that just kind of grabs you straight away. Joe Satriani is absolutely one of the most popular guitarists in music history. He's a 15-time Grammy Award nominee, and he's had sales of over 10 million albums, making him the best-selling instrumental rock guitarist of all time. What is it about Joe and his style of guitar playing that's clearly resonated with yourself and with all of us for such a long time?
I think there's a couple of elements that make his playing quite popular. So as well as being technically quite proficient, he also has very nice ornamentation on his notes. So you don't just hear a big string of notes all in a row. You hear like ghost notes, slides, bends, vibratos, and those little touches a lot of people won't realize, but they make it sound a lot more enjoyable than most shred guitar music. And he also has a very song orientated structure to his music. So it's not just a big string of complicated key changes, time changes, and guitar solos. You can hear the melodies being repeated at different points and slight variations on them, like listening to a song. So it's almost like he has a lot more of a song-orientated or maybe even a vocal approach to his playing that a lot of shred guitar players don't. So I think that's what makes him so popular.
And I mean, you've touched on this was the first album that you discovered. I mean, over the years, Joe's played with the likes of Mick Jagger, Alice Cooper. He's one quarter of Chickenfoot, who for many people would be the best supergroup this side of the millennium, or one of, certainly. And he has this fantastic solo career behind him as well. Do you lean more towards his solo albums, like Surfing with the Alien, or have you kind of followed him across his other projects too?
For Joe Satriani's work, it's mainly his solo albums that I really get into. His other stuff is all great, but just the solo albums just blow me away, all of them. They're absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. So Joe's journey with the guitar starts when he was 14. So apparently Joe heard about the death of Jimi Hendrix at football practice, and he quit football to become a guitarist. And he was so proficient by his late teens that he himself was teaching guitars to others. So some of the names of people he worked with read like a who's who of guitar heroes. So we're talking Larry Lalonde of Primus, Kirk Hammett from Metallica, and most famously Steve Vai. So thinking about guys like these, is it easy to see elements of Joe's style in their playing? And are these guitarists that you're also a fan of?
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I don't listen to Kirk Hammett and Steve Vai play and think, oh, that sounds like a Satriani style thing there.
Yeah.
They've all developed their own unique approaches and voices, which is maybe a bit more of a testament to Joe's ability as a guitar teacher, as well as a composer and musician.
So, I mean, guitarists in the mid-80s were in quite a unique place. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about Jimi Hendrix there already. Guitarists like Jimi Hendrix, David Gilmour, Tony Iommi, right through to Eddie Van Halen, and many more had all come before. And there seemed that there was very little left to do at that point. So Joe, in an interview with Classic Rock Magazine, said, "You'd look back and think, my God, they've done everything. Hendrix took it so far out. Yet there were players like Clapton who were saying, I'm going to make it blues and not take it too far out. Even by the mid-70s, when I was growing up in New York and playing clubs, there were the beginnings of punk rock and disco was becoming strong as well. It made you scratch your head and think, what am I going to do? And I guess that's it. That it must have been really difficult to stand out from the crowd at this point. And, you know, how do you think that Joe does that? And obviously we'll touch on this throughout the interview. How do you think that Joe does make himself stand out from the sea of guitarists that were out there at this point?
That's a really good question, actually. I'm not entirely sure. I think I get the impression from listening to his music that he always focuses on just writing really good songs. He doesn't sound too preoccupied with trying to make the next Jimi Hendrix record or the next kind of grunge style thing. He just focuses on writing a good song to, from what it sounds like, to the best of his ability, which is great. And I think with that approach, he's always just found a way to write good music, and good music is always going to be good music, and people are going to want to listen to it.
Absolutely. And I mean, Surfing with the Alien and Joe in general are credited with popularizing, and you used this term earlier on, shred guitar and shredding, along with guys like Steve Vai and Yngwie Malmsteen. For those not necessarily in the know, what do we mean by shredding, and is it correct to label this album as a shred metal album?
I think shred guitar in general, you could just very loosely call guitar playing with a very high technical ability. So being able to play very fast and complicated passages on the guitar, being able to apply note ornamentation and complex uses of rhythm, including time signature changes, I guess, and being able to tie it all together into one cohesive musical unit. I'm not sure I'd call Surfing with the Alien like a shred metal album, because it's technically very proficient and the songs are great, but it doesn't sound heavy enough to be classified as a metal album.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I just know that obviously that there's some people out there, it does kind of get thrown into that category. And I think that once you get deeper into the album, there is a lot more there, not to kind of devalue that shredding sound at all, because there's definitely elements of that shredding on this album. But I think what makes it so accessible is that Joe really runs the gamut and genre across this album, as you say. So to merely call it a shred album, it just doesn't take into account just how much is going on across the 10 tracks.
Yeah, there's a lot of musical variety in the album, which is, I think that's something he does a lot in all of his work. In all his albums, you can hear quite a variety of approaches and instrumentation and stylistic changes as well, which is probably another reason that makes his music so accessible and also interesting to keep listening to.
Yeah. I mean, I have a quote from Joe here, kind of talking a bit about this issue that we're discussing now. He said, those guys like Yngwie were beautiful examples of players perfecting one thing. I wasn't like that. I was a collection of crazy influences that could be difficult to put on one record. I still wanted to celebrate Chuck Berry and Wes Montgomery. Plus, I was still a kid who really liked playing Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath. And I think that's what you hear. You hear this kind of celebration of the guitar. You know, we talked a bit there about where does Joe fit in with all these guitarists that come before. I guess he, in some ways, I feel it's like a celebration of what everything that's come before across all 10 tracks, but then everything that's unmistakably him as well.
I think that's a really nice way of putting it, actually. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, this concept of celebrating all the guitarists that came before him, that was actually how Joe pitched the album to Relativity Records boss Barry Corbin. Barry famously said that he didn't know what to do with Joe, as he didn't look like a rock star or make music like a rock star. In that sense, do you think this album could be seen as a bit of a gamble? And I mean, it's not as if instrumental albums are seen as huge sellers usually. Even kind of bands like, say, Pink Floyd, who would have a lot of instrumental elements in their album, very rarely would they be doing a fully instrumental album like this.
Yeah, I think an instrumental album would probably be seen as a bit of a gamble. But I think back when it was released, record labels were maybe a bit more inclined to take gambles for something they considered to be musically great every now and then, which they're not so much inclined to do nowadays.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's something that we talk about a lot, that, you know, record companies were willing to take that gamble. They were willing to try something a little different, whereas kind of in the day and age we are now, obviously people independently can do what they want, but the record labels they have a particular sound they're looking for, which kind of stifles things, sadly. It's a bit disappointing.
Yeah, but I guess at the same time, for the record label, it must work as well. Otherwise, there'll be bankrupt.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, this was actually Joe's second studio album. The first was 1986's Not of This Earth. I know you'd said that you love all of his back catalogue. What do you think of Not of This Earth, and how does it compare to Surfing with the Alien? Can you see a progression?
Yeah, it's a really cool album, but I feel like Surfing with the Alien was a kind of just like a step up and a general improvement across the board compared to Not of This Earth. I don't know, maybe it was because the title track was the first one I heard, and this was his first album that I listened to. But that's probably why it was so special to me, just because it was the first album I listened to that had this kind of music on it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Surfing was produced on a budget of $13,000, which even in 1987 was a really small budget. Joe actually only used three guitars across the entire album, two Kramer Pacers and a Stratocaster. And most of the drum sound on the album comes from drum machines. Again, this was due to the small budget.
Mm.
Joe has said in the past that this gives the album an awkward charm. Do you think that sometimes working like within these tight restrictions or a small budget, do you think that that can kind of like bolster creativity, like kind of really get you to think outside the box? Or is it more that there's a danger of kind of being stifled by the financial or physical restrictions that you have?
I think it probably leans more to the former with this one, because... Mm-hmm. The album sounds great, and you don't listen to it and you think it's a cool album, but those programmed drums really drag it down. they kind of fit with the whole thing that's going on. Yeah. So I think in this situation it worked, and he pulled it off and got a great result from it. I mean, if it was on like a really, really low, like a punk album budget, it would have probably suffered. I mean, I don't listen to this album and think it could have been done better or there's something missing from it. It just sounds like a great album to me. So, exactly. Yeah, I think they pulled it off with the budget really nicely.
Yeah. So we just said there about how Joe only used three guitars on this album.
Mm.
And Joe spoke to Music Radar, and I'll touch on this interview he did with them quite a few times because it's invaluable for kind of information about the album.
Yeah.
And he was speaking to them about one of the Kramer Pacers, and he'd said the guitar itself was always falling apart. Guitar tech Gary Breuer was continually trying to fix it, but I had a connection with it, and that became the guitar I used for my first EP, and Not of This Earth, and then Surfing.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Is there something to be said about, you know, I'm sure now when Joe goes in the studio, he has kind of the top of the range, up-to-date guitars and this and that and the other, but is there something to be said for kind of your connection to an instrument, even if it's fallen apart, and how much more important that is compared to if you did have something top of the range and brand new and swanky? Is there something about that connection with your instrument that's really important?
Yeah, I think there's probably two aspects to that. One is, every instrument, even ones that come off a production line, all tend to be slightly different. And you kind of, you adjust your instrument. If you go and play a different one, like a different type of guitar, or even the same model, but a different one, they usually do feel slightly different.
Mm.
So there is something to be said for being comfortable with something like that. And when you're in a recording studio doing something, and you've spent all this time preparing for it, writing the music, practicing it, there's a lot of money at stake. You know, it's got to be done in like 3 or 4 days or a couple of weeks, whatever it is. So it's like a time constraint. You don't kind of want to be, well, I guess I wouldn't want to be playing through 30 different guitars and all of them feeling slightly different. I just want something comfortable that I know I can play, I know I can get the result from, and just kind of stick with it and get on with it. And maybe there's a bit of that sort of thinking at play. He had this guitar, it worked for him, so he just stuck with it.
Yeah. And I guess there's something about that emotional connection there as well. And I mean, obviously the as a Queen fan, the way my mind always goes is kind of Brian May's guitar and the red special that he kind of built with his father as a child.
Yeah, that's
you know, it is. Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, I mean, obviously we are diverting a little bit, that guitar, you know, made Brian's career. It's got that really distinctive sound. And I mean, he sometimes plays replicas and stuff on stage now, but there's something for him about playing that original guitar, even though parts have dropped off over the years and they've had to kind of restore it and play around with it somewhat. So maybe even though this Kramer was dropping to bits, that there was something that Joe loved about it. He had that emotional connection to it too. And perhaps there's something in the playing of that as well that helps us connect to the songs more.
Yeah. I mean, he must have spent so many hours playing on that instrument and practicing on it. It would be hard not to form some sort of emotional connection to it.
So, I mean, we've touched a little bit on the low budget of this album and those constraints during production. Even when the album was finished, Joe discovered that when it came to master Surfing with the Alien, that half the album was unbalanced. So he told Classic Rock the label was already upset because we'd spent twice as much money as we were supposed to. I'm not sure if that means that the budget was actually half of 13 and they spent that, or whether they went to 26, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
The studio said we could remix those 5 songs for free. We went back, remixed those that we thought were masterpieces. We had no recall. This was all analog mixing. Then we went back to LA and did the mastering all over. It was extremely traumatic. Wow. So it just seems like when we factor all this together that, you know, maybe the equipment they had wasn't the best, you know, they had these budgetary constraints, the label didn't know what to do with them, and then they get there and there's those issues with the mastering. There's so much going against this album, yet the quality just ascends above all these kinds of issues. And 30 odd years later, me and you are sitting chatting about it as a classic album.
Yeah, I mean, it's a testament to Joe Satriani's character, I guess, not only to be able to write and play all this great music, but then to deal with all those problems that came up along the way and find a way around them.
Yeah. Yeah. So it feels like the success of this album was in some ways a happy accident. So as we've said, the record company weren't sure what to do. Joe just wanted to make an album that celebrated his love of guitar. And while the production of Surfing, while creative, it was quite low key. Upon its release, Surfing with the Alien reached number 29 on the Billboard 200. And it spawned 3 hit singles, which of course we'll touch on because we're going to go track by track shortly. And from what I can gather, Joe went off to tour with Mick Jagger, came back from that tour, and he was a star made overnight. And I guess the question is, what is it that this album has that it resonated on such a level so quickly as well?
It's a tough question. I guess it's just different to everything that came before. I mean, it's got, like you said, that celebration of music, but it's not just kind of copycatting and cloning it. It's bringing a lot of new stuff in his own way, putting it all together. That's just refreshing and enjoyable to listen to.
Yeah, absolutely. Just before we go track by track, I want to touch on the album cover, which has always been one of my favourite album covers of all time. I absolutely love it. The cover includes Silver Surfer from Marvel Comics on the front and the hand of Galactus on the inside cover. Now, when I discovered this album, I didn't know what Joe Satriani looked like. So, and I imagine a lot of people didn't. So, I mean, the album's music paired with the Marvel artwork on the front, it just kind of led me into this world of imagination, which I think just makes the cover such an inspired choice. What are your thoughts on the album art? And do you think it was a clever move by Relativity to pursue and try to get Silver Surfer on the cover of the album?
Well, I'm glad Joe Satriani doesn't dress like that on stage.
Well, yes.
But it's just a really cool album cover. I think when Joe Satriani originally wrote the song Surfing with the Alien, he didn't intend for he wasn't thinking on the lines of the Marvel comic character. No. Yeah. It was just kind of a happy coincidence. Maybe that's part of the reason the album's success. People would have known about the character from the comic book and recognised that, which maybe made them more interested in checking out the music as well.
And I think what's just to touch on that album cover for a little longer, but I think it's a real shame is obviously when I've been, you know, when I research these podcasts and I revisit these albums, if I'm ever listening via streaming, obviously I have my streaming subscriptions and that. And if I listened to Surfing with the Alien and the artwork was actually not there, when I've looked into it, apparently the kind of the deal that Joe had with Marvel Comics expired a couple of years ago and they couldn't come to terms with kind of renewing that. So any future reissues of the album that come out won't have that iconic cover.
Bummer.
Which I think is such a shame. So I think if anybody listens to the podcast and then kind of listens to the album and decides that they want to own it, absolutely go back and get one of the older editions. I don't know if it's been reissued since these kind of issues have gone on, but you need the cover, really. It's such a cool part of the album. And as I said, it's one of my favourite album covers of all time. I absolutely love it.
Oh, I completely agree. It's a great cover. It's a real shame that I haven't been able to renew the deal with Marvel Comics for that.
I'm wondering if, obviously, because Marvel are a much bigger entity now than they were back in 1986, 87, that possibly it would cost quite a lot more for them to secure those rights, obviously, with all the movies and stuff now. We'll head into track by track, and we'll start with our opener and the title track that we've touched on quite a bit already, Surfing with the Alien. Chances are, if you're not familiar with Joe Satriani and you're listening today, but you think you've heard anything, it's likely to have been this song. What are your initial thoughts on Surfing with the Alien? I know we've touched on you hearing it for the first time. And again, what was going on for you as you kind of listened to that over and over in those early days?
So I love the opening riff of that song and it really catches me. But the big thing for me when I first listened to it was when he goes into that really intense tapping section somewhere around the middle. and that just absolutely blew me away. I just couldn't get enough of it. It was great.
I've only recently just learned to drive. So I passed my test literally last month. Mm. And I was driving to work the other day. And obviously, because I knew we were chatting, I was listening to Surfing with the Alien. And the moment this song came on and I was kind of driving down an empty road about 50, 60 miles an hour, I thought, this is why I learned to drive. It was just the most amazing experience. And obviously, I've loved this song for years. But then that gave me a whole new kind of context, because I've always had this image in my head of almost kind of that the song takes you on a journey from in my head, it's a first person perspective that I'm kind of flying around with, you know, if I am the Silver Surfer, perhaps surfing through all this stuff. And so then to be driving and to be able to go at that speed, I really enjoyed it. So I just wanted to share that, because I think it might, I imagine it's a very popular driving song in that regard.
I do enjoy driving fast with Joe Satriani playing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So Surfing with the Alien is renowned for this kind of recognisable wah-wah sound. Joe told Classic Rock that its use was actually unplanned. He said that, "I stuck my wah-wah pedal in my bag as I was leaving my apartment. I hadn't played with it in years. I brought it to the studio, started playing, and we got something going with this harmonizer and thought, this is a lot of fun." So, I mean, that's crazy to think, you know, a lot of the elements of the song, that this song was nearly very different to what we know it to be today.
Yeah, I think a lot of the solos on the album in general were quite improvised, apart from a couple of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's really cool. He was able just to sit down and come up with these ideas on the spot in the studio. That's really cool.
Yeah, and we'll touch on a couple of those songs that were less improvised as we go on, because I think that Joe does have opinions about that. We talked earlier about that small budget, but we didn't discuss the impact that would have on like physical studio time. So Surfing with the Alien was victim to a serious lack of studio time. Not, of course, that you'd know it now, listening back 30 years on. Once Joe and producer John Cuniberti had found their sound, they actually only had 20 minutes left. And as you've said, much of what we hear on that final track is improvised, and it's what Joe managed to throw down in 20 minutes.
That's absolutely mental.
Yeah. Do you think that sometimes, and obviously you'll have that experience in the studio too, do you think that our best work can be when we're under that intense pressure? That the quote I've got from Joe is that there were literally people waiting at the door to come in. They were like, you know, "Your time's up, we're using the studio," and he's kind of finishing off whatever it was he was doing. Do you think sometimes that pressure can bolster that creativity?
I think sometimes it can, yeah. I mean, I've had a few moments in the studio myself when I was recording some of the tracks from the album Impetuous Desire. And the clock was ticking and there were solos to get finished. So we finished 1 or 2 minutes before the studio time ended. So I think that definitely can happen, but I wouldn't like to plan on that happening, if that makes sense.
Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. As we touched on earlier, once the album was finished, Joe went off as Mick Jagger's guitarist for a tour. And by the time those shows were over, he had a hit on his hands, and this song was a huge part of that success. Considering that instrumentals aren't traditionally, from a chart perspective, they're not traditionally as successful as songs with vocals, what do you think was making this song so popular in 1987? Bearing in mind that I think 1987 was a huge year for rock and metal. We've talked a few times on the podcast about some of the greatest albums of all time were released in 1987.
Well, it could be people were just hyped up in general from the previous great albums that had been released, and people always want more. And this album came along with just the right kind of stuff at just the right time, and just kind of intercepted the market at just the right point, and people just lapped it up and couldn't get enough of it.
So Surfing with the Alien reached number 37 on the Billboard Modern Rock Tracks chart, and instantly became stuff of guitar legend. Readers of Guitar World magazine ranked it the 30th greatest guitar solo ever, which I think is a pretty impressive achievement.
Yeah.
What do you think? Obviously, we've talked about the impact that it'll have had at the time. What do you think has helped this song stay relevant and celebrated by music and guitar lovers for over 30 years now?
I think something I mentioned earlier was that something Joe Satriani does really well with his playing and songwriting is keeping a vocal quality to his guitar playing. It's a very expressive quality as well. And also his music is usually very nicely structured, which sometimes a lot of instrumental music isn't. So it's almost like he wrote the song for a singer, but then the guitar's playing all the lyrics rather than having someone sing them.
I think that's a really good way of putting it. I think that really kind of hits the nail on the head. We'll move on to Ice Nine, which is the next track on the album. And I think what's interesting here is that not only, it's not just a case of Joe's thought, oh, that sounds cool, I'm just going to play that, that there's a story behind every song on the album. So Ice Nine is said to have been inspired from the novel Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut, which that was about scientists who develop a chemical which turns water into ice. And then naturally, because it's used for war purposes, things go wrong. And that's what the song is about.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and I think that's what's really cool. Obviously, there's a few of the other ones that I'll be able to give you that inspiration for what the songs are about. Joe told Music Radar, I was just thinking about something so insidious and cold and hoping of things tightening up and becoming ice. So this was my description to all of the players when presenting the idea. Do you get that vibe from the song? Does everything feel kind of like tight and icy, for lack of a better term, from a musical standpoint?
In retrospect, yeah, I can see that. I remember listening to the song. I enjoyed listening to it, but it kind of had, it didn't have the, on say maybe the energy or the explosiveness that some of the other tracks have. For example, Surfing with the Alien has really nicely. It always felt a bit more kind of constrained, which I guess fits with the icy nature of the backstory.
Yeah, and I guess this is a great example of how Joe can, obviously he's got something in mind, he's got a backstory in mind, and he can present a vibe and a mood to a song without any lyrics or vocals whatsoever. And I think some people who are listening might think that I'm kind of at a pain to mention this, but there are literally no vocals on this album at any point. Yet he's able to get across the themes that he wants in his songs, even if obviously we don't know that's what the song's about. We're able to get across that vibe and mood of what he's trying to get across.
Yeah, it's the mark of a great composer when you can express an idea without stating it in words.
Yeah. Ice Nine feels more like a traditional rock track than kind of the shreddy goodness we've just heard from Surfing with the Alien. Although there is some great shredding on this as we get deeper in. If we take into account Joe's idea of kind of celebrating his love of great guitarists over the years, do you feel that Ice Nine, do you feel like it's paying tribute to anyone in particular, or does it feel very much kind of his track?
With all the songs on the album, I don't feel like there's one particular guitar player or song by some other group that I could attribute the influence to. I think with a lot of Satriani's playing, for me, it's kind of like he took all the influences, like crushed them all together into a bowl, and everything Joe Satriani writes is a big combination of influences coming out. It's very hard to kind of take a single strand or a single line from anything and say, this is attributable to this guitar player, this is attributable to this guitar player. Yeah. And that's the impression that I get, at least.
And that's Sam Russell there, chatting with me about his chosen classic album, the first instrumental album we've done on my classic album, Surfing with the Alien by Joe Satriani. And we'll get back to my chat with Sam in just a little bit. What are your thoughts on the album? Do you think an instrumental album qualifies as a classic album? What do you think of tracks such as Always With Me, Always With You that we'll be talking about in a little bit more detail when we go track by track? Get in touch and let me know what you think. Coming up, how influential is classical music to the sound of Joe Satriani? And what exactly is the pitch axis theory? All that and more right after this. Enjoying this episode of my classic album? Don't forget there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes as part of Season 1, with guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favorite band or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Blota.
It sounded great then and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway. So yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener right there.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes, such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash fight. I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but this was a weird. I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 Years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and on Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network.
We'll move on to Crushing Day. So I find Crushing Day a really interesting track on the album. Out of everything on Seven with the Alien, for me, it feels the most metal. Joe said in the past that out of all the songs on this album, that Crushing Day echoed the time that it was produced. Would you agree with that statement? Do you think it feels dated as a result?
I can definitely see it reflecting the time it came out. I mean, the riffs and the melody, they really give it that metal sort of vibe. But I wouldn't say, well, then again, I guess most music I listen to is from like the 80s and the 70s. So for me, it wouldn't sound dated.
Yeah.
But maybe someone else would give a different answer for that one.
Yeah, I guess that's what's difficult. It is very much down to kind of personal preference as far as that goes. I love the riff on this one, but a lot has been said about the solo on Crushing Day. It feels like it came from a frustration throughout Joe's career as a session guitarist previously, and that now we had a chance to break free from those constraints. So I have a quote from him here. He says, "The solo section's really long, and I have to say that part of that is that I was so frustrated as a struggling session player that I was always told to stop playing. Like, no, don't do that. Don't make those noises. No, you're playing too many notes. You can't use that technique. No sweep picking. Play more like that other thing or that other guy." Going into the solo record, both John and I were like, "Hey, we're just going to do what we want to do. There's nobody here to tell us we can't turn the guitar up or have a 382 bar guitar solo." So I guess it's this moment of him kind of breaking free and thinking, "I'm going to do what I want. I can do that now. Finally,
yeah.
Here you go."
I can sympathise with that. When I was writing and recording the album Impetuous Desire, I felt exactly the same way. I mean, I played in bands previously and people would be saying, "Oh, you can't do that here. It sounds too complicated. Stop playing so many guitar solos." And then I write my own album and I can do what I want. So I can finally put 5-6 guitar solos into a song if I want to and play as fast as I want. Yeah, so it's a refreshing feeling, I guess. It all kind of blurts out at once.
Absolutely. So this solo is the only solo on the entire album that wasn't improvised, as far as from what I can gather. I personally don't think that's a detriment to the song at all, but it has made the song difficult to emulate live, as Joe felt that unless the solo is replicated precisely, that the song falls apart on stage. Joe's gone as far as to call the song his nemesis. Can you see where he's coming from here?
I think guitar players tend to have a handful of approaches when it comes to playing solos. Some like to improvise solos, some like to play things note for note, and some kind of like to have 75% of the solo written and 25% of it improvised. So I guess if you're a player that likes to improvise the solos, which it sounds like Joe Satriani likes to do, playing something note for note is going to be, stressful, because it's just not what you usually do and you kind of have to change gears when it comes to that song. I tend to prefer playing things mostly note for note, so I actually kind of prefer that.
So, I mean, interestingly, when Joe's friend and student Steve Vai heard the album for the first time, he said of Crushing Day, "Yes, it's a really cool song. Solo's kind of worked out though, isn't it?" So with the knowledge that we now have, do you think it's clear to see the work that's gone into Crushing Day, particularly with that solo? Does it stand out against the more improvised nature of the rest of the album?
I'm not sure. I think... well, you've done a very impressive amount of research into it. I think when I listen to this album again, I'm going to be listening to it very differently than I did before doing this this podcast with you.
So we'll move on to Always With Me, Always With You. This might be my favourite song on the album, to be perfectly honest. Always With Me, Always With You really slows things down. And again, without the use of lyrics or vocals, Joe creates like a really beautiful love song. What are your thoughts on Always With Me, Always With You? And how on earth does Joe manage to put across such beauty in this song?
I absolutely love this one. It's one of my favourite ones from the album. It's a bit more special to me than other ones, because when I was at music college, this was actually the song I did for my final performance, which was really cool to do. As to how he communicates the certain ideas, I guess that's down to his skills as a composer. In very broad terms, you can communicate a different feeling using very fast notes to very slow notes, and then all the sort of little melodic devices, his use of harmony, the use of effects he uses, the tempo, all kind of help come together in a very organic way to help create a very specific mood, which is clearly communicated through the song as being a love song.
So we've talked about kind of shredding and that complexity and the skill involved in Joe's style and doing it right. I think this song works because it is very simple and understated for the most part. Mm. And Joe says he wrote it with simplicity in mind. So he told Music Radar, the musos will always roll their eyes because they're looking for cluster chords and unusual time signatures and challenging things. But if you walk around in the real world, you think, I went to a stadium and there were 100,000 people singing the song that had three chords in it. This is humanity. This is people coming together, being united by a simple melody or a simple chord. Do you think that's a key to the song's enduring popularity? That it is very simple. And so in that sense, maybe the casual music listener does gravitate to that more.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, if you look at some of the greatest melodies throughout history, not just with rock music, like going back through to like classical and baroque music, it's always going to be the simpler melodies which stick in your mind. I guess just because it's easier for your mind to process them. So I can see a simple melody always being more popular than a very complex one.
Yeah. So Joe also told Music Radar that he looked to the likes of Chuck Berry and even Beethoven in terms of simplicity. So it's funny you should be talking about classical music and studied how they did what they did so effectively. So we've already touched on classical music. How influential do you believe that style of music is to Joe Satriani's sound?
That's really hard to say. I think you'd probably have to ask Joe Satriani that.
That's fair enough. Fair enough. Always With Me, Always With You is a good example of the effectiveness of drum machines on this album. So although that was a budgetary thing, we established earlier on that we agree that that's not a detriment to the album at all. A drum track was recorded, but as the song was mixed, those drums fell away and this very minimal drum machine sounds are all we have left. And Joe's guitar really takes center stage. We do have one track on the album with actual drums. I believe that's Satch Boogie that's coming up next. Overall, do you approve the use of the drum machines on this album, particularly on Always With Me, Always With You?
Yeah, I mean, like I said before, that to me, the whole album sounds great. I mean, the use of drum machines, I don't listen to the album and think, oh, the drums suck on this. I mean, for me, everything just works. So like you said, I don't think drum machines are detrimental. They just worked really nicely for it. Yeah. I think part of the drums were overdubbed with parts of a real kit, but not all of them. So maybe that helps give it a bit more of an organic feel and less of a slightly robotic feel you might get if the album was 100% drum machine.
So Always With Me, Always With You has the distinction of actually been nominated for a Grammy Award 3 times.
Wow.
Once for this studio version and twice more for live versions over the years. Have you heard live versions of the song? And I know we talked about Joe as a live guitarist a little bit earlier on. How does he develop this song in a live setting particularly?
It is a great, great track. I guess there's just must be bits he's changing live or doing some improvising with, which just help create a nice variation or twist on the song each time he plays it, which is really cool.
Yeah. So we'll move on to Satch Boogie. The genesis of Satch Boogie came from an unfortunate car accident that Joe had just before a tour in Europe, which led him to be sent home in a neck brace. So wow. Joe told Song Facts, I couldn't really do much, so I just stayed home for a week. And as I sat with my guitar, I couldn't look down at my guitar because of the neck brace. I was thinking I might as well just write some music as I'm sitting here. And I had this crazy idea as to what it would sound like if there was a horn section trying to play with Gene Krupa on the drums, as if his set was falling down a flight of stairs. And I thought, this is the kind of thing you only think of if you're on painkillers and in a neck brace. And I think this is testament to Joe's talent as a composer, as we've been saying throughout, as he worked on so much of this song and he wasn't even able to pick up his guitar initially to form the ideas that were kind of going around in his head.
That's crazy, yeah.
There's actually a really interesting video on Guitar World's website where Joe talks about Satch Boogie as well as teaches us how to play it. And he cites saxophone player Eddie Harris as an inspiration for his performance on the song. Do you know much about Eddie Harris? And would you agree with that comparison?
I've never heard about Eddie Harris before, to be honest.
Don't feel too bad, because neither had I. But it sounds like, from what he says in the interview, it was someone that his mother used to play around the house a lot. And it was more about kind of the energy that Eddie brought to his performances that he was trying to get across in a song like Satch Boogie.
Oh, cool. That's really cool if you take something from saxophone playing and kind of incorporate that into his guitar playing.
Yeah. So in that same interview, Joe comes out with something that I think just encapsulates everything that's great about him and this album. He says, sit back and imagine the greatest melody, and if it's awkward, work it out. So what he's saying is that there's just something about that. I think that sums up the album perfectly, that some people might think, oh, well, I don't think I could play that, or I don't know how I would play that. Whereas Joe, he thinks of it and then he works it out later. And I think that just sums up his album perfectly.
That's a great way of putting it, that is. I like that.
So Satch Boogie is always held as perhaps one of the strongest examples of what's called the pitch axis theory. So this is a musical technique, for those who don't know, including myself, used in constructing chord progressions. Now, as I said earlier, I'm not a musical person. I struggle to get my head around that. Are you able to shed some light on what we're talking about when we're talking about the pitch axis theory and how that relates to Satch Boogie?
Yeah, maybe see if I can do like a 30-second music theory lesson here. So in music, we have something called a scale, which is where you start from a note and then you move a certain musical distance away from that note to get the next note, and a certain musical distance to get the next note, and the next note, and the next note. And when you look at all those distances are what defines the scale. So your major scale is one set of distances from the root note. Your natural minor scale is another set of distances. Your Byzantine scale is another set of distances, et cetera, et cetera. Pitch axis theory is sometimes more specifically used for kind of modal playing, which I can come back to in a second if you want to.
Okay.
But it's when you take the same starting point and then construct different scales from it. So, for example, all the scales might start on the note A. So one part of the song might be using the A minor scale. Another part of the song might be using the A major scale. So very roughly, that's what pitch axis is.
Cool. So much of the ingenuity in this song comes from Joe's desire to try new things on the guitar. So he told Music Radar, for the middle pitch axis section, I wanted to take two-handed tapping to a different level. So with Midnight, which we'll come on to later, and with this section, I was thinking, what has Eddie Van Halen not done? I mean, Eddie's just a genius. He's the number one guitar player of my generation, but I'm not going to step on his toes. So I applied things to the idea of tapping the board that I thought moved into an area that Eddie hadn't explored. And then using it as a bridge in a Boogie song, I thought was the weirdest thing. I just love that. I love how when you do a bridge that's so weird and then the song starts up again, you go, oh, right, it's the Boogie. Obviously, we've talked about Eddie Van Halen a couple of times here, and I think you've made it very clear, and I agree with you, that although we're celebrating the guitar and celebrating guitarists, Joe is very much creating his own sound here. Do you see Eddie as an influence on Joe? Or do you think there is that conscious effort to maybe move away from his style, as he said there, that he doesn't want to step on his toes so much?
I haven't thought of it before, but I guess Eddie Van Halen, one of the big things he was famous for with guitar playing, was, which he kind of brought to the limelight with Eruption, was the extensive use of tapping, which is something Joe Satriani also does notably use on this album. I think I mentioned with Surfing with the Alien, that tapping section was one of the things that blew me away. And it's got tapping sections in quite a few other places in the songs. Always With Me, Always With You's got one. Satch Boogie's got one. A few others as well. So I guess, you could say that it's probably strongly influenced by Van Halen there. But he does also do something. He's not just copying Van Halen. He's kind of taking that technique and, like you said, figuring out something else to do with it and applying it in his own unique way, which is really cool.
So we'll move on to Hill of the Skull. Joe said that this song was inspired by the poetry of Khalil Gibran, and one poem in particular, which is about the crucifixion of Jesus. So the line that inspired the title, so saying, he placed his hand upon my free shoulder and we walked together towards the hill of the skull. What kind of images does this song bring up for you when you listen to it? And can you see that it could potentially be linked to something like the crucifixion?
Yeah, I didn't realize it had quite such a biblical backing to it. But when I listen to that song, I do get a kind of desolate sort of feel to it. It has got like a kind of dark, haunting sort of sound. You wouldn't call it a happy song.
No.
Yeah, I mean, the way it's a short piece of music, it's kind of mainly like one main theme being repeated. It does kind of feel like you're kind of walking down like a dark path somewhere you don't really want to go, maybe.
Absolutely. I mean, Joe says of the song, well, talking about sort of the themes within the song, he says sometimes when you're brought up with something from childhood, like the crucifixion and Jesus and all that, it just becomes part of a story and you don't really think of the human aspect of it so much. So I was thinking, well, if I was going to write music to that event, it certainly wouldn't be glorious religious music I've heard where there's beautiful harmony. And the music really alludes to the religious aspects of the event. I said, what about the music for the human aspects of it? That's the horror of the whole thing. And that's an interesting concept that, you know, we think about the crucifixion, you know, as children growing up in England, we go to school, we're taught about Jesus and Christianity and that story. And we don't necessarily think of, you know, the horror of the actual act of what that crucifixion is. And I think that Joe's music captures that extremely well.
Yeah, it's a really interesting way of putting it. It kind of shows that he's a really intelligent guy.
Yeah. This is, as you just touched on there, one of the shorter songs on the album. It's less than 2 minutes, and it does kind of have that one sort of theme that's repeating. Do you think that there could have been more scope to develop Hill of the Skull, or do you think that it kind of says its piece in the 2 minutes? Are you kind of happy with the track as it is?
I think it works what it is. It's, I think sometimes when you write music, there's things which you can expand into much longer, like 3, 4, 5, or even 10-minute pieces of music. But some ideas just fit being a short, self-contained unit, and to do any more would spoil it. I sometimes wish one of some of my favourite Netflix shows would take the same sort of approach and no one to call it a day.
Yeah. We'll move on to Circles. I think this is probably one of the most underrated tracks on the album. It starts very slow and simple and then bursts into that kind of Satriani guitar work that we know and love, and then comes back to that kind of slow and lush sound, bringing the song itself full circle. What are your thoughts on Circles, and do you think it's an underrated track on the album?
Yeah, so for me, I found the first half of the album to be the more popular half. The singles from those ones got a lot more recognition. But the second half, while it doesn't have the heavy hitters in terms of getting the chart positions with the single tracks, it's still got some great music on it. And I think, yeah, like Circles, Lords of the Karma, Midnight, and Echo, they're all great pieces of music as well. But they're just great, but not in a way that would be popular like the prior songs on the album are.
Yeah. I mean, I get particularly sucked into those slower parts of the song at the beginning and the end. There's just something about them, as great as that middle section is. Do you think that, and again, thinking about the, you know, those popular singles, particularly Surfing with the Alien and Satch Boogie, do you think that we all too easily forget the subtle elements of Joe's playing sometimes and just how strong he is at melody as well as technical ability? Because I think Circle's a great example of just how strong he is with melody.
Well, yeah, I guess the slower music with Circles gives you a chance just to sit back and really appreciate the melody without all the crazy guitar work and getting in the way of it. Maybe a little bit like Always With Me, Always With You, but even more extreme than that.
Yeah. So Joe said to Music Radar about the song, it's the juxtaposition with the beginning and the end that makes it such a release in a way. That's what I think I've learned when listening to the great classical composers, that they use complexity and simplicity like they were equal tools. And that's not often the case in modern music. Usually bands get stuck on one or the other. But classical and jazz music has treated these two elements equally, as equal tools to send a message to the listener. So this was going through my mind for the whole album. But I do think that Circles is a really strong example of that, that, you know, it's light and shade. It's kind of the slow moment and the fast moment. And it is that they're just as important as each other. And as he puts it, they're equal tools.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It's interesting that he says in that interview that he was specifically studying classical composers, which I guess answers the question earlier.
Yeah.
I agree a lot with what he said as well. I think it's become even more extreme with modern bands, is they do one very specific thing and have one very specific sound. And you can listen to a whole album and it's like you listen to the same song 10 times sometimes. Whereas with Joe Satriani's music, you can hear, and he's got the intention behind it as well. There's a lot more variation moving through the different songs and inside the songs as well. So he's taken a lot of the different elements of music and very consciously decided how he's going to use them at different points in time.
So we'll move on to Lords of Karma. This song probably has the longest life prior to Surfing with the Alien. Joe says he came up with the chords at high school and kept them back until he felt he could write a song around them, as he felt the chords were very unusual and like nothing he'd heard before. Would you agree that the song is somewhat unusual in regard to the chords?
Yeah, I don't know specifically what chords he is using, but I've always enjoyed the unique sort of sound that song brings to the album. Yeah. You listen to it and it's not just like a straight up rock song. It's got something a bit more exotic to it.
Do you think that, obviously you've touched on this a little bit already, do you feel that helps that it stand out on the album for you particularly? I'm guessing you would say in some ways that it's a highlight because it stands out for that kind of unique chord progression that it's got.
Yeah, the exotic harmony does may help make it stand out for me. I guess it's just another element of music, and Joe Satriani's chosen to focus on it with that harmony for that song, which is cool.
I also really think that the use of sitar really helps it stand out against the rest of the album. Does Joe explore the sitar or any other instruments across future albums other than the guitar?
Well, there's a few different instruments used across several of the songs. There's a bit of orchestration in here and there as well. Nothing comes immediately to... I can't remember on the spot if he uses a sitar anywhere else and any of his other albums.
This is a song that, obviously, talking about Joe learning it at high school and all this sort of thing, that a lot of credit towards the song comes from his music teacher, Bill Westcott. So Joe told Classic Rock magazine, "My high school music teacher, Bill Westcott, had a big influence on me. He taught Steve Vai as well. He was great. He was our Yoda." Do we know much about Bill? Like, obviously, I couldn't find much information about him, and it seems crazy to me that this guy had such a huge influence on two of the most celebrated guitarists of all time, in Joe and Steve Vai, and yet we don't have a lot of information about him.
That's the first I've ever heard of him. I guess not. I mean, I guess if he didn't do many compositions of his own, then there wouldn't really be anything to remember him by.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's still around or not.
No, I think I'd read, actually, one thing that I did find was Joe had actually posted a tweet a few years back when he passed away to kind of pay tribute to him. So he obviously was a huge influence on him. And I guess it's a shame that we don't know more about that relationship. And, you know, obviously there's certain things. I'd read that Bill actually kind of introduced the pitch access concept to Joe and that he was really kind of grateful for that as well. So, you know, it is almost a shame that we don't know more about that relationship, because I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah, that would be. I mean, yeah. Now you brought it up, I really wish I knew more myself.
Yeah. So we're getting towards the end of the album. We'll move on to Midnight. Midnight has this almost kind of Baroque feeling to it. Joe revealed that the song is meant to conjure up images of a weird ceremony in the middle of the forest late at night. Again, I've asked this for a couple of the songs. What image do you get when you hear the song, and can you relate to what he's trying to get across?
I'm not sure. I'd know. That almost sounds a bit on the verge of something a bit culty or satanic when it's stated like that. I don't quite get that sort of vibe from it. I get kind of the nighttime sort of vibe when I listen to it. I'm not thinking of something set in Salem with the witch trials.
Yeah. So, I mean, Midnight's unique in that Joe wrote the melody and then he worked it into a two-handed piece. There's some videos floating around on YouTube of him playing Midnight, and it's great to watch. I'd thoroughly recommend them to anyone who wants to. We've talked a little bit already about that kind of two-handed tapping style that obviously Eddie Van Halen uses in Eruption, and it is something that's prominent in metal and rock, and it's something that Eddie is seen as kind of pioneering and popularizing. We talked earlier about Joe respecting Eddie without wanting to emulate him too much. Would you agree this is kind of another great example of that? So again, he's using that technique, but he's not covering ground that Van Halen have covered. He's taking it in another direction.
Yes, like we said before with Joe Satriani, everything he does is kind of, you can see where he's taken it from maybe, but you wouldn't say it's a clone or a copycat of what's come before. He's always doing his own unique thing with it. And yeah. I think that'd apply to this as well.
So there is some debate as to whether Eddie Van Halen invented tapping. Although there's no doubt, as we say, that he played a huge part in kind of popularizing it and pioneering it within the genre. Research has shown that tapping was actually used as a technique by composer Niccolo Paganini, although he used it initially on the violin rather than the guitar, although he did play the guitar. Do you think that Midnight has that kind of classical Baroque kind of quality to it?
I guess I could kind of see that. I mean, it's not the first thing that comes to mind when I listen to that song. But you could certainly say it's got Baroque sort of influences. And you mentioned earlier, Satriani said that he studied Baroque classical composers in general. So when you study something with the intensity, I imagine he would have studied it, the influences are going to come out here and there.
So our final track is Echo. Joe says of the song, "Echo was a song that was about a story I'd heard from a relative about a friend of theirs whose first child had died in either childbirth or prior to being born.
Oh, wow.
And when they had their second child, they named it Echo as a tribute to their first child. And the thought stuck with me about different human beings somehow being connected through time as being part of each other." And so that's why the song has a very moody, repetitive thing. What are your thoughts on Echo? I guess that's a very deep, almost kind of philosophical story behind the song. Do you get that vibe that that's the time kind of story he's trying to tell with a track like Echo?
Wow, that's kind of dark in a way.
Yeah.
I enjoy the song, but when I listen to it, it doesn't kind of conjure up philosophical problems to me.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah.
I enjoy it. It's dark. It's got kind of the repetitiveness, but in a nice and tasteful way, so it's not boring. But it's really interesting to hear that was the idea behind the song, and to maybe look at it in reverse order. So rather than looking at the song and trying to see what Joe Satriani was thinking, hearing what he was thinking and then looking at the song in that light is really interesting.
So in terms of it being the end of the album, Joe credits producer Johnny Cube Cunny Bertie with sequencing the album. Mm-hmm. And he insisted that Echo closed the album. Would you say that's the right choice? Do you think that Echo is the right choice to end the album?
Definitely, yeah. I like how it kind of brings, the album starts off really strong and then the pace kind of comes down, especially at the end there, to like finish it off. I think that was a good decision. It works for me. I really enjoy it.
Yeah. So we've been on this huge journey on this album across all sorts of genres and planes. And obviously there's all sorts of themes going on in the songs and inspirations for writing them. We get to the end of the album, and usually the question I ask is kind of, how does this track end the album for you? But we've already discussed that a little bit, I think. How do you feel at the end of this album? You know, you've played it from start to finish. How do you personally feel once you get to the end of the album?
I feel like I haven't practiced guitar enough every time I listen to it.
Fair enough.
Fair enough.
It's really nice. It's a really well put together album, and it feels like a journey when you go through it, which I like. It's not just a random collection of bits and pieces. There's really nice variation through the album between the songs. So the songs don't just all sound the same song in the same key with the same sort of thing going on. Everything is very nicely composed and performed and structured. And it's just a very enjoyable 40 minutes to sit down and listen to.
Kind of to wrap things up, it's an album that, against all odds, became a huge hit album. It's one that catapulted Joe Satriani into that conversation amongst the greatest guitarists of all time. As I said, we've touched on that Music Radar article a lot today, and their track-by-track analysis with Joe is definitely worth a read. Joe says at the end of that article, "It was a quirky record, out of time with what was happening. It was a weird collection. I wasn't the fastest guitar player. I wasn't the most outrageous guitar player. There wasn't anything on it that was right up for the time. And yet it did embody a very honest snapshot of who I was as a player, where I'd come from and where I wanted to go. And so it was the perfect album to become a multi-platinum success because it actually gave life to my career. It didn't kill it." So with that in mind, why does Surfing with the Aliens stand the test of time for you?
I think for me, it's just purely down to the quality of the songwriting. A well-written piece of music is always going to stand the test of time. That's why we still listen to stuff from the Baroque and classical eras, which are hundreds of years ago. And a good piece of music is always going to be a good piece of music, whether that's today or 1,000 years from now. And Surfing with the Alien, the whole album is a good piece of music. So it's always going to be enjoyable to listen to. No period of time will ever be able to change that.
And finally, why is Surfing with the Alien your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
For me, it was because it was one of the first kind of guitar-orientated pieces of music I'd probably listened to. I'd be learning guitar for a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months at the time. And my guitar teacher introduced me to this album, and it just completely blew me away. It opened up a world which I didn't know was even possible with playing guitar, and I just fell completely in love with it. And it kind of set me off on a journey of, well, a decade, trying to be able to play as fast as possible so I could keep up with the album. Why other people should listen to it, it's just a fantastically written album. It is instrumental, but it's done with a very song-like sort of feel, which I think is, like we said before, one of the things that makes it accessible to people who don't usually listen to instrumental music, maybe. So I think there's going to be something for everyone, and a lot of people, if they gave the album a chance, would probably be surprised by how much they enjoyed it.
Well, Sam, thank you very much for joining me. It's been great to chat about a great album as well, a fantastic choice for the podcast. So I know obviously you had a bit of chat about your album. This is out now. Have you got any other music on the horizon at the moment?
Yeah, so I did the heavy metal album Impetuous Desire. And if your listeners want to download a couple of the songs for free, they can go to my website, www.samrussell.co.uk, and put your email in on the front page and I'll send a few songs across. Before that, awesome. I did a Baroque album, so I did a electric guitar cover of Bach's first and second cello suites, which I think was the first time those have been done on guitar in full. Next things on the horizon for me are I'm just finished writing an album of guitar and cello duets, which I'm currently learning to record in a month or two, fingers crossed. And then I'll be finishing off writing the second metal album, and then I've got a couple more classical covers planned and a third metal album after that. So I'm keeping myself busy and releasing an instrumental track every week on YouTube as well.
So a special thanks to Sam Russell there for chatting with me about Joe Satriani surfing with the alien. And I love that we've done an instrumental album. You know, we've done a soundtrack, we've done an instrumental album. The Wall's probably going to be our first double album. You know, it's nice to do things a little different and to change the format up every now and again. So thanks to Sam for choosing a truly unique album and for taking part. As you heard, Sam is so busy with all sorts of stuff, and he is a very, very talented guitar player in his own right. Get yourself over to www.samrussell.co.uk to see everything that's happening with Sam. It was an absolute pleasure talking to him, and again, thanks for choosing an awesome, awesome album. So we do have another episode of My Classic Album coming up in just a couple of weeks, but that's all we've got time for today. I'm not going to tell you much about the next one just yet. It could be one of two albums, it could be one of two guests, it genuinely depends as to who I get to first, but you will hear it first on the social media pages. So keep an eye on My Classic Album with Mike Norris's Facebook page, My Classic Album Podcast on Instagram, at @MCA_podcast on Twitter, and of course, www.myclassicalbum.co.uk for all the latest goings on with the podcast, all the latest going on with our special Pink Floyd's The Wall episode coming up in about a month's time. And yeah, I guess that's it from me. So I will see you in a couple of weeks. Cheers.